G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to the Technical Tennis Podcast, and hey Jacob.
Hey Glenn.
Hey, so over the last like 14 years, how many workouts would you say that between the two of us we have planned and overseen for collegiate and professional tennis players?
That is more math than I can do on the fly.
I mean, it's thousands at this point.
A lot.
Yeah, I mean, like it's multiple. I mean, we're talking between the pair of us, probably what, 10,000, 15,000 workouts, something like
well,
that.
Well, so depending on if you're a tennis player listening, that's fine. If you're a strength and conditioning coach, you know, we may count each actual program instead of each person for whom we've programmed. But I mean, you're looking at like small groups. So it could be like a group of like three or four people on one program and another three or four people on the same team, even on a different program.
Right.
So
but regardless,
it's a lot of people and a lot of programs and a lot of lists.
It's a lot. So I'm bringing this up because I recently did an AMA, and it's an Ask Me Anything on Reddit for those of you who aren't Redditors, on the tennis subreddit there. And I'll post a link to that in the show notes. But, you know, I've done three or four of those over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. And every single time, inevitably, at least one, and sometimes two or three people, ask me about how to do workouts for tennis. And I think this is something that's really poorly misunderstood. And you and I haven't talked about this in a while. So it might be that we don't even necessarily sync up 100%, but I think that that's not a bad thing. But this would be a good episode for us to talk a little bit about how we think workouts for tennis should be done. And obviously we're not going to go into specific programs for individuals here because that wouldn't really fit in the scope, but you know, kind of talk about it in principle, the guiding ideas behind what the needs are of tennis, the physical needs of tennis, and the kinds of things that we think tennis players should be doing.
Yeah, I mean, someday I'd like to sit down and go through in detail actual programming for tennis players. But before we can do that, I think it makes sense for us to just sort of throw some ideas back and forth and chat around about it in a more formal way.
Informal way, I think you meant to say.
No, I meant more formal, but not,
structured?
Not the point where we, not structured.
Okay, so, tennis is an odd sport. If we look at, let's say that I want to be a distance runner. Well, essentially most of that's going to come down to I'm going to hyper-specialize in endurance. And if I want to be a sprinter, I'm going to hyper-specialize in explosiveness. And tennis is it kind of fits in a weird space because you have to be good at such a wide variety of physical skills or physical attributes in addition to actually practicing the skill aspect of the sport. You have to have endurance, you have to be explosive, you have to have agility, you have to have balance, you have to have hand-eye coordination. It's an odd thing.
It's an incredibly challenging thing. It's more like being a decathlete than it is being a distance runner or being a lifter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have to be a jack of all trades.
Or maybe a bit like being a gymnast.
Maybe a little bit, but even then
I feel those guys are strength dominated.
Yeah, they're very strength dominated and probably not as much on the endurance side of things in a sense of things. So, and one of the other things I think that makes tennis very interesting is that, I mean, realistically, if we break down what actual points and match play looks like, I mean, you are doing very short, I mean, like sub 10 second bursts of theoretically, massive output of energy. Being extremely explosive, followed by, 10 to 25, or if you're Nadal, maybe 35 or 45 seconds of rest. Wow. And sorry, I had to.
The shot clock is coming.
Sorry, Rafa. And then you have to do it again and again and again and sustain this over the course of between, 1 to 4 or 5 hours, depending on, whether you're playing best of three sets, best of five sets. And that's a very unique combination. I'm not sure that we see anything like that in any other sport. I mean, there are other sports, I think, that mimic the on-again, off-again nature of tennis, but they don't do so over such a sustained period.
Yeah. I saw a good example the other day. Some of my guys played a doubles match, and they actually lost in straight sets, two tiebreakers. But it was an hour and 45 minutes.
Right.
Just like doing an hour and 45 minutes of box jumps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just something. It was just something that like you don't do. Yeah, it's like do some box jumps and then, you know, take 10 seconds off and then do it again. It's just a weird, it's a weird sort of pattern. So it's tough to plan for. I mean, you know, we come from different places, which I think is one of the reasons that I find these conversations interesting personally, because I mean, I don't want to rag on myself too much, but like when I compare myself to the pros, like when I compare myself to the guys that I coach, right? Or if I compare myself to you, I was not a very good athlete.
Right.
Okay. Now, in general terms, I was a pretty good athlete. Like I played a lot of sports and I was pretty successful at all of them. But it's a different level when you're talking about top 200 guys, and your athleticism and your level of athleticism was certainly on that level. That's not a question, and I'm not going to even let you talk about that because he has a tendency to deny it. But then the way that you approach this is to some degree biased from that perspective of being an athlete, where the way that I approach it is, you know, more from purely an analyst who then, you know, sometimes successfully and sometimes unsuccessfully learned a lot of these skills and improved at least tremendously.
Right. And to put this, I guess, in a little bit of perspective here, I mean, you've done a lot of actual formal coursework on anatomy, physiology, and a lot of the things that go into creating a successful athlete, you know, at a graduate level. And that's, I think, a big part of this divide. So whereas the way that I look at it, you know, you grew up being a pretty good athlete who then went and did formal learning on training and the physiology of how we change our body's performance. Whereas, you know, I grew up doing those things and being trained in that way. And so a lot of my understanding of it was always intuitive. And then I've done a smattering of education, but nothing structured or formal. So I've just learned things here and there because I'm curious like that. You know, I'm the guy who reads neuroscience books before I go to sleep at night. And so there's that very different perspective. And yeah, I think that definitely does make it an interesting conversation, because I have a lot more experience of the actual doing side of it, and you have more experience of the formal learning side of it, and where we meet kind of. Well, I guess we'll figure out where we meet, because we haven't talked about this in a while. So
curiously, for both of us, you know, the way that we think about a lot of these things has changed over time.
The first
thing that you started with was, it sounded to me like talking about one of the obstacles to general physical preparation.
Right. Well, what I was trying to do is just kind of put a bit of a framework, because if we can lay out relatively clearly what the requirements of tennis are. I mean, look, if you don't know what it is that you have to do, it's very hard to prepare. You know, if I just said, hey, Jacob, 6 months from now, I'm going to require you to do a physical test, and I'm not going to tell you what's in it, then you have to go out and do a little bit of everything and prepare for a little bit of everything. Whereas if I said, hey, Jacob, in 6 months, you're going to have to go out and run the fastest 100-meter dash of your life, well, that's going to change the way that you prepare, obviously. So framing out the physical requirements of the task we're going to do is the first step in preparing for it.
You know, that's funny, because I want to stop you right there. That is the first step for you.
Well, yeah.
But when I'm dealing with players, and I'm talking about players on the tour here, all the way down to 3.5 players that have just, you know, decided they want to get better and become 4.0 and 4.5 players. They don't frame things in that way. They come from a perspective of, usually it's more like, I know what my weaknesses are. I know what I need to do to win. I need blank, fill in the blank here, to get better. Whether it's be stronger or to have better endurance, or it's usually one thing or maybe two things, but they don't actually do what you just did, which is step back and frame the entire challenge of training a tennis player.
Right. And sure. But that's why we're talking about it, so that we can give people the tools to do this themselves.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's the starting point, I think, is like we figure out what it is that we have to do, because look, if we, if we talk about what physical training actually is, you know, what we are literally doing is we're adapting the body to specific performance tasks. I mean, if I take an average human being and I make them run, you know, a marathon, they're probably going to do very poorly, and there's a very good chance they're going to injure themselves in the process. Whereas if I take, and then what we do when we train is we literally force the body to adapt to that task of distance running. And you know, gene expression, I mean, there's a whole lot of things that go into that.
But if you train them up slowly, then pretty much everybody can do it.
Everybody can do, you know, almost, I mean, anybody can get significantly better at almost anything when it comes to physical, as long as they do the right type of training. And so framing up the what it is that we're trying to do is step one. And so understanding that for tennis, we have to be explosive, we have to have endurance, we have to have recovery, like quick recovery, and we have to have agility. And so that's a very, like we said, it's more of a, you become very much a generalist in a way that you don't have to be for most sports. Because, you know, it's you need explosiveness not just in your legs, but in your upper body too. You need the endurance in both the upper body and the legs. You need, you know, agility. So having said all of that, like I said, like basically physical training is adapting the body to specific tasks. And so I guess the next step is, what comes next? So now that we know what it is that we're trying to do, roughly, you know, how do we prepare to do that? You know, what are workouts look like? Like what are the types of workouts that we need to be doing to get ready to play tennis at our best level?
So what does your general philosophy when it comes to training a player look like? Like, how do you think about the training?
Well, so there's a few things that go into that. I mean, obviously we've got performance is at one end of the spectrum, right? I mean, our goal is to maximize our performance, but there's a point where, as a tennis player, you're not maximizing your performance for a single moment in time the way like an Olympic sprinter might, where they're literally peaking for a specific, I'm peaking for this one race, and or these 3 days in a 4 year span. And for a tennis player, it's, well, I've got to play well on Saturday and then turn around and play well again on Sunday and then probably turn around and play well again on Tuesday. And so there's the second part of this is the closer I get to my absolute peak performance, the closer I also get to injuring myself. You know, in terms of if I'm trying to get every last little ounce, because if I'm an Olympic sprinter, knocking off 300th of a second off my 100 dash time is the difference between winning an Olympic gold and getting a silver. Whereas if I'm a tennis player, that it's, you know, I have to
that
be able to do this task. Yeah, that, I mean, that 300th of a second may not matter. Or I should say, yeah, it's the cost of that 300th of a second is that I'm going to play 50% less tournaments in the year because I'm going to be hurt, because I'm always riding that edge. And the closer we are to that edge, the more likely we are to hurt ourselves. So, you know, there's finding that balance.
I want to clarify that point because it just may not, it might have slipped by people because I didn't catch it right away. But it sounds like what you're saying is, like, take the Olympic sprinter, for instance. They run sub 10 seconds for 100 meters. They're probably 100 times more likely to get hurt running sub 10 seconds than they are if they run a 14 or 15 second.
Meters. I mean, for those guys, a 14 or 15 second 100 meter, that's just a jog. I mean,
right, you know, so they would never get injured.
Yeah, I think they're like 12,000 times more likely to get injured doing the sub 10 second.
Kind of like you or I would never get injured just like hitting cross courts.
Right, and the second part of that is I think they're far more, significantly more likely to train to injure themselves in training trying to get to a 9.8 100 meter dash than they are if they were training to do, let's say, a 10.5 second 100 meter dash over and over again. Right.
Assuming that they're pushing themselves and they're getting close to
their limits. Yeah, because it's like in training to do that 10.5 repeatedly, you're not at that absolute edge of your physical performance. And so that's an important idea, right? And I think for a lot of people listening, that may not be incredibly relevant, but for the college players and the budding professionals, that is. Because I think, you know, the average recreational player probably just wants to improve their physical conditioning for tennis.
Well, I think it's relevant for all of us because the average player that I've worked with over the last, I don't know, 15 years, I mean, what they do is they go out and they try and get really, really good at one thing, whether that's bicep curls or sprinting or distance running.
Right.
You know, they think, like, I'm going to be the best guy.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, the thing I run into a lot is I'm going to be the fittest tennis player alive. And these people get really heavy into jogging and biking and stuff. And then they severely neglect two things, which is one, the strength aspect of the sport, the power aspect of the sport, and the second is the interval aspect of the sport, because it's really high intensity intervals.
Or it should be.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It should be.
How do you think about what a player then actually needs to get better at?
Well, I break this into a few different things. I mean, like I said, you have to go out on the court and you have to be explosive for a relatively short duration, have a very short rest, and then do it again. So to my mind, there's a few aspects here. The first is building the baseline strength. Like, if you're not strong, I think it's very hard to be explosive over and over again without hurting yourself. You know, I've seen people over the years who are inherently very explosive. Like, they have a great neurological capacity for quickness. But if the underlying strength isn't there, I think you're more likely to injure yourself.
For the record, that's where I know that this one is about this podcast is about just normal people, but that's the category that I put Nick Kyrgios into.
Sure. Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Neurologically, is just a beast. There's a huge concern that he's going to get injured,
right? Because the baseline strength and conditioning isn't there, and so, you know, I think you have to build baseline strength, and to me that means, you know, multi joint compound exercises, squatting, pull ups. These kinds of things where I'm, you know, like if I take a squat, you know, there are so many joints involved with that. I'm using my hips, my knees, my ankles, and all the musculature surrounding that. And so I'm going to do those kind of traditional strength training exercises. But I'm not doing them for size. I'm just doing them for the strength. I mean, the goal is to get as strong as possible with adding as little size as possible, ultimately. And then the second aspect of that is endurance, because it's all well and good to be strong, but if I'm strong for 5 seconds and then I'm done for the day, which I know people, not tennis players, thankfully, but I know people who are like that, because, you know, they're hyper-specialized in strength. So, you know, you have to get your running in or your swimming and your biking and these other longer duration exercises where you're just putting your head down and going nonstop for 20, 30, 40 minutes.
Now, to be a pain in the butt,
sure,
basically. I believe it's been a long time since I've looked at this, and so I'm second guessing myself, but I believe that you're referring to stamina as the ability to do a certain intensity over and over again, where endurance would just be like someone could say, like, well, I can walk 150 miles nonstop. They've got incredible endurance. But if you ask them to run quickly for 30 seconds, they can't do it.
Right. Well, it's endurance with intensity, I guess, some level of intensity. I'm certainly not talking about, you know, running at marathon distances, but, you know, getting some baseline endurance.
People will do marathon type training, but, you know, then we say, okay, well, let's look at your times, and they're running 10-minute miles.
Right.
And even for someone who, I mean, I have a client right now that I'm working with that's in his 50s, like, I don't want him to run 10-minute miles. That's not bad for a 59-year-old lady, but that's not what they need to do to be a better player.
Right, sure.
Issue, right?
Yeah, no,
they need
absolutely
more stamina over a higher intensity that they're actually going to use on tennis.
Yeah,
court.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason I mentioned the 20 to 40-minute duration, because, I mean, I think at that kind of duration, like, you shouldn't be going super, super slow, right? And then the third piece of the puzzle to me, where this is where the rubber meets the road, is doing high intensity interval training with what I would call like neurologically complex movements. So an example of that would be like a dumbbell snatch or a dumbbell jerk, or, you know, box jumps and burpees and things where we're using basically our entire body in an explosive movement, and we'll do that for relatively short duration and then have short rest. So at that point, we're mimicking the rest, work rest intervals of tennis. Maybe not matching it, but, you know, mimicking it in some way, and doing that with an explosive movement, and with that uses the whole body and also engages the brain to do these complex movements, so that we're have to sustain. Because, you know, the second part of it is, like, look, it doesn't matter. If physically I'm a beast, but my brain fatigues out, then I might not even feel physically all that tired, but I might start missing everything because, you know, my strokes just fall apart.
Yeah, people don't talk about that very much. So without losing people too quickly, there's a neurological load that you mimic essentially by doing, say, a really complex movement with high intensity like that, which is just to say, you know, think of it like I'm going to hit, you know, the hardest serve that I can, you know, just three times in a row really quickly. That's something that anybody can do once or maybe twice. But after you do that 5 or 10 or 15 times, usually people fatigue out and they start to completely lose control over where the ball's going to go in terms of they can't hit their targets anymore. What's happening there is their brain is fatiguing. They're right. Losing neurological control over it. It's absolutely. Not like their arm isn't strong enough to swing the racket anymore. It's not right. Like your legs have gotten tired from hitting 10 hard serves. Okay. But we have to keep track of those things in tennis. So to some degree, you can use completely different exercises like that, like doing a, you know, a dumbbell snatch is one of my favorite exercises.
Oh, absolutely. It's a very complex movement. I mean, you're literally involving every part of your body in that.
Yeah. And your body can just generally adapt then to get used to the stress of saying, I'm going to use my whole body explosively and I'm using essentially a massive effort, but in a safe way. Right.
Yes.
And get used to doing that again and again. And that's one of the things that, you know, as tennis players improve, you use more and more effort in one sense. You know, the goal, of course, is to make it effortless. But on the way up, you use more and more effort to hit the ball harder and smarter and in better places.
Right. And well, I think in a sense, if I can interrupt there, but I think the goal is to make it look effortless. Tennis is never going to be effortless. You know, but there's that part where it's like, well, I want to be in control enough that when people watch me do this thing that is really actually happening with a lot of effort and very high intensity, I don't look like I'm on the raggedy edge where I'm on the verge of falling apart the whole time.
And tennis is only effortless when you're just flat out dramatically better than your opponent.
Right. And that's not, we don't train for that. I mean, we train to put ourselves in that situation, but those aren't the people that we have to prepare to beat.
That's just not that much fun. The fun comes when the competition is fairly close.
Yeah. And so this brings me to the last part of the puzzle as well, which is the psychological part of it, because I think it's all well and good to get physically prepared. But if you're not comfortable, and this is kind of built in with that, especially that last part of the puzzle with I just used the last part of the puzzle like twice in a row in different contexts. So that's going to be awesomely confusing for everybody. So if I am fit, if I have a level of reasonably high intensity endurance and I'm reasonably strong, that doesn't mean that I am psychologically comfortable towards my physical limits. You know, if I go out there and play or I do something at really high intensity, I'm going to start to feel really out of breath. I'm going to start to feel a little bit like very physically uncomfortable. And there's a psychological component to that, which I think is underrated, where, you know, a lot of people hit that space and they back off or they give up. And I think it's important to train as you're training when you get into the high intensity interval stuff is to put yourself into that space so you get used to it. And when you get into that space, it doesn't make you freak out. You're comfortable being uncomfortable, so to speak.
My teams in the past have had a saying, we earn our confidence.
Yeah, I've noticed you've used that.
A lot like what you're talking about. And that's one of the things that we've talked about as teams is, you know, when you've done all that work, I mean, you don't second guess it when you're on the court. You're not even thinking about it, right? And what happens is you come off the court, you know, the team's done well, you've won some matches, and you get compliments from your opponents and from other coaches, and they say, like, oh, you're playing with so much confidence. And you're just looking at them like, what are you talking about? And then in retrospect, you realize, oh, yeah, well, I have confidence that I could go out there and do whatever needed to be done because I prepared for it appropriately in the gym.
Right. Well, you know, one of the analogies that I use a fair bit with people is tightrope walking. you know, let's just say that I took a 1 foot wide, or for non-Americans out there, basically the rest of the world, a 30 centimeter wide plank or line on the ground, and asked you to walk along it. I mean, you'd do that without even second guessing. I mean, and you wouldn't put a foot off. And if I then took that a plank that wide and put it 100 feet up in the air and asked you to walk along it, all of a sudden, you know, you'd be inching along, your palms would be sweaty, you would feel very, very uncomfortable there. But if I, you know, if you train for that and you practice it and practice it and practice it, and this is what tightrope walkers do, I mean, they're walking literally on a piece of string or a piece of rope at that kind of height, and they don't doubt their ability to do it. And there's that whole familiarity breeds contempt idea. Look, if you've never seen something before, you're not used to it, and it's strange, then it can be very psychologically uncomfortable, and that inhibits performance. You know, if I'm worried, I'm not going to perform well.
Right. If I then doubt my ability, yeah. We still need to some degree to think about what we want to do on the tennis court, whether that's cover some of your weaknesses, improve some of your patterns, or just where you want to hit the ball.
Absolutely. So, I guess we've got to kind of tie this back, because we've gone very much into the theoretical side of things here. So I'm going to be in the gym and I'm going to be doing some traditional strength training. But when I do this, I want to be doing, like I said, I don't want to go in and do bicep curls. If I want to get my biceps working, I'm going to do pull-ups. Because one of the big things about any really genuinely athletic movement is there's muscle integration. My brain has to be able to recruit different muscle groups in a coordinated fashion to get maximal performance. If I go into the gym, I do a bicep curl, well, my brain's teaching my bicep to move by itself in relative isolation, and it's not coordinating. And so I want to try and hit movements that involve multiple joints and multiple muscle groups and teach my body how to work them all together. And so they grow together and they learn to perform together. So that's the strength portion of things. So I'm going to go in, I'm going to do squats, I'm going to do pressing, overhead pressing, I'm going to do pull-ups, I'm going to do those kinds of movements, deadlifts. And then for the endurance side of things, I'm going to maybe run or row. But I'm not going to go out and I'm not going to run for an hour, because I think the intensity level there has to be so low that it becomes less useful for tennis. I might run 3 miles very quickly. I might run 2 miles very quickly. I might run 4 miles, but I'm not going to go out there and run 15 miles. And I'll do the same thing with rowing. I might row 5,000 meters, which is, you know, like a 20-minute row, or I might row 6,000 or 7,000 meters. But I'm going to keep the distances and the times of that, the speed fairly high, and the time frame, you know, probably 30 minutes or less. And then the last part is the interval training, where I'm going to go in and do things like box jumps and burpees and dumbbell snatches and Turkish get-ups and other things that involve my entire body in an interval fashion with really high intensity, high difficulty level. And that's basically the three pillars on which I'm going to build my physical conditioning for tennis. So pick that apart, Jacob. What do you disagree with? What would you do differently?
So I think that there's a difference between our base philosophy, right? Like, one of the things that stands out, let's just take the place where you finished off there with intervals. You do highly complex movements in an interval fashion. Now, that's great training if you can do it well. Now, I happen to know you, and Glenn can do it well. So that's great for you. It's not great for a lot of people, and I'd probably even say the vast majority of people. It's something that you have to work up to.
Sure.
So if you have like a really good CrossFit coach or weightlifting coach, someone that, you know, can make sure that you're doing this stuff really well and that you can maintain form and technique and whatnot over time, then that's probably going to work really well for you.
Yeah, can I just cut in there? I just want to add in, because I don't want to give the wrong idea. I think what constitutes a complex movement changes from person to person and where you're at, you know, what you bring to the table. For one person, that might be, you know, snatches, like barbell snatches at your body weight, and for another person, that might mean like literally zero weight squats. where you're just squatting with no weight on your shoulders whatsoever. I mean, so that's going to change depending on the individual.
Right. Make that like my good. Like my 59-year-old woman that I was referencing earlier on the podcast. And for some people, I mean, look, I've had people work up to snatches, but they're just snatching with a 10-pound dumbbell.
Right. Yeah.
But that's been really, really great for them. I organize some of those things differently, so I'm much less likely now to use those complex movements in interval training and much more likely to get on a rowing machine or
But see, I think rowing is a complex movement.
Rowing is a complex movement.
To me, rowing
yes,
absolutely counts because, I mean, you look at all the muscles and the joints that you're using in a single rowing pull. And, you know, you've got all the – to me, like, I look at that. It's like I'm using multiple joints. There's a sequencing that's important, like when I use the different joints and muscles around them is important. So, I mean, rowing absolutely counts to me.
Yeah, and it does to me. I combine those. So instead of doing, like I don't have anyone go run 4 miles. I don't even have anyone go run 2 miles. Like, I just don't do it. I haven't done it for a while now because – well, there's a couple of reasons, but in the first basic reason is because people tend to think that they can run very, very well. And so when they think that they're very good at something, they pay much less attention to their technique. And so it becomes a place where they can waste a lot of time. Whereas if I put them on the rower or even if I put them on the bike, they're much more open-minded to focus on the technique, on what they're actually doing and on controlling their body. So I combine sort of that cardio aspect of doing things you know, extended in that 20 to 40 minute range with intense interval training.
Right.
But before, you know, without getting lost into those details and before going to that, the place that I start from is different. The place that I start from is instead of thinking in terms of generally just getting stronger or getting better stamina or getting faster, right? Which is usually what I find my athletes think of, like, well, I need to get faster, or I need to get stronger, or I just need to be able to last longer. Occasionally some people are just like, well, I'm just really bad at like this one movement. What I think of is deconstructed movement patterns. So for instance, I was working with a college player yesterday on his serve. His serve's not bad. I mean, he's a Division I college player. It's actually pretty good. But his shoulder movement is trashed in my mind. Mm-hmm. in the sense that his shoulder movement is actually, he's got like micro injuries in it, and he's got severe limits to his range of motion in a couple of places. He's able to compensate for that because actually he's doing a lot of training like what you're talking about. He works really hard. He's very strong. He's very quick. And he has fairly good stamina. One of the things that he's found is that he fatigues, you know, as he gets into three sets, his serve isn't as good anymore. And so what he's trying to do is make it better by just getting generally stronger. And the philosophy instead that we use is, well, let's figure out what's going on specifically with your shoulder and get your shoulder better at that.
Right. So, well, I mean, you're talking about basically an injury or a physical limitation.
Right. Well,
I kind of separate that from working out, you know, I mean, like the workout side of things in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, we've all got injuries and we've all got physical limitations. The way that I start putting together training programs for people now, though, is based around a handful of movements. So shoulder movement, like good shoulder movement is good shoulder movement, whether you're playing tennis and you're serving, or whether you're playing baseball and you're pitching, or whether you're playing American football and you're a quarterback. Good shoulder movement is good, healthy shoulder movement, and it should translate to all those sports. And likewise for swimming even. One of my guys was a very good swimmer, and you would think he'd have great shoulder movement. But I think from swimming, he actually had developed some weird patterns. Those were the ways that his body compensated to deal with the load, right? Mm-hmm. So what I think of is like you need good shoulder movement, you need good hip movement, you need good ankle movement, like you need some of these basic things, right? And then I put together the programming around those things with a big focus on technique and getting those movement patterns down right.
Sure. But I do want to cut in here. I mean, I feel like for the average person listening, they're going to struggle to be able to set that up. You know, I mean, really, to go and do their workouts at their gym, they're not going to have a biomechanics expert. They're watching their ankle movement.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. And so that's really, really changed things for me probably over the last 5 years, because in the past, like, I mean, we did programming for teams together on and off for some years. And, you know, we'd put the program together, but then like one of us would actually be there to help cue people and make sure they were done well and whatnot.
Right.
Now what's changed for some of my programming more recently is that I've added some things in that in the past I would have been philosophically opposed to, because they would have been too simple, right? But I've added in some simple movements to help teach some of those patterns when I'm not there, and when there is no expert there, and when there's no one around to cue them. So, you know, a lot of the people I work with now are on their own. They're just, you know, they're on their own.
Yeah.
Like they're going to go to the YMCA, or they're going to go, they're traveling, they're going to go to the hotel gym or whatever. And so my programming then has changed some from, it includes now some simple movements. Like here's a terrible, well, here's an example that I would have cringed at 5 years ago. I used to hate every time someone did a bicep curl. Well, I started to find that there's a certain sort of group of people. Maybe I just group them that way, but there's some percentage of people that we train them, and then, you know, what they would do after everything else that they had done, they'd go in and they'd do some bicep curls, because it's like they wanted to do some bicep curls for one reason or another, right? They watched an Arnold Schwarzenegger film or something, I don't know. So I got frustrated with that, of course. I used to just tell them, don't do it. Well, I don't fight it anymore. Now, instead, what I do is try and teach them, okay, well, how can you make a bicep curl actually helpful for your tennis game? Mm-hmm. You need to have a healthy bicep, yeah, but you don't really need to do bicep curls. But hey, if you're going to do them, then let's look at your technique, let's look at your shoulders, let's look at your posture, and let's make it actually a postural move. So let's focus on your breathing and your posture when you do that, instead of focusing on, I'm going to just, you know, curl as much as I can. So we can shift that focus. So my programming has taken a big shift in its focus to breathing and posture and movement patterns generally, to say, even if you're going to do a simple movement like a bicep curl or a simple press, which is just, you know, taking a weight and putting it over your head, or bending down and picking a weight up, right? But then let's focus on shifting our posture in a tiny little way to a better place, so that we can be in some way better today physically than we were yesterday. And so the goal really is not to build a more powerful athlete, but just to build a better athlete.
Well, but I mean, to me, a better athlete is a more powerful athlete.
You know, yes.
If I can execute a basic physical movement with better posture and better biomechanics, then I'm going to be able to do a better job.
And you will also be more powerful. Yeah. I really confused two uses of the word powerful there. When we think of powerful, what we think of is probably bigger and stronger. But like, again, to go back to Kyrgios as the example, he's not like, he doesn't have bulging muscles at all.
I mean,
right?
He's a pretty big boy.
He's a huge guy. He's 6'5".
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's not just that. I mean, like, he's got a big back. Like, he's, but posturally, he's got terrible posture.
Well, posturally, he's got some issues, but I'm saying, like, his muscles don't bulge out. Like, he wears tights because, right, like, he's not as lean and, like, muscular as all of his opponents to a T.
Certainly, maybe not as lean. I mean, I think he's got some.
Certainly not as lean. But in a way, you know, I mean, it's not like he's fat. Like, he's not big. Like, he doesn't have a belly.
No,
he just doesn't have as much muscle mass. But the point being, power is not directly related to muscle mass. Yes, if you increase muscle mass, you can be more powerful. But before that can happen, you have to make the neurological connections. So my programming has shifted now to be probably lower weights with a bigger focus on postural stuff and the neurological work. Mm-hmm. And then building people up to the point where, for me, it's like when you get strong enough and you're stable enough so that we can do high intensity intervals with complex movements like a snatch, or when you get to the point where I say, like, you're going to do a lift and you're going to do box jumps and we're going to stack these in intervals, then that is sort of the pinnacle of the training.
Right. And I think
what I would do with you or with Rafa, but that's definitely not where I start with people.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things here for people listening to keep in mind is that, you know, you may not have access to the resources to do that, to have somebody guide you and make those judgment calls and stand there and watch your technique and make micro adjustments. But if we look at it from a broader perspective of what types of things should you be trying to do in the gym, would you sum that up for me? Like, if you're the average Joe who doesn't have access to a personal trainer or access to, you know, a biomechanics specialist to go in the gym with them, like, short on time. Like, what would you?
I think you hit the nail on the head with everything that we went through at first, and as you graciously laid everything out and just let me rebut. I think you hit the nail on the head with the big concept that people miss is get better at everything.
Right. So, like I said, those three pillars of strength, endurance / stamina, and then the high-intensity interval.
Yeah, and...
in those exercises, obviously, will change on where you're at physically. I'm not going to take... You know, if you're an absolute beginner in the strength realm, you're not going to go in and start trying to squat your body weight. I mean, you have to learn how to do a proper squat first.
And the first thing that I ask people actually is, what have you got? Or what do you have? Because some people will say, like, I have 4 dumbbells at my house and I can only work out from 5:30 to 6 a.m. in the morning. Make me a better tennis player. And the truth is, you can do that. You can become a better tennis player with just that. It's not ideal, but you absolutely can do it. And so, you know, and then some, like, for the guys on the road, I mean, take a challenger player or a futures player. You know, they're like, well, I have bands and, you know, a grand total of like 5.5 pounds of equipment that I can travel with because it has to fit in my suitcase and make airline regulations every week.
Right.
How do I get that?
And really quickly, this is the other big thing I think is worth talking about in the last few minutes we have left, is the importance of using free weights versus, you know, static machines.
Yeah, so that one should be really simple. Like, when we talked about the bicep curl, the first thing you said is, you know, if I want to develop my biceps, I'm going to integrate them into bigger and better movements like pull-ups, which is right. Like, you don't need to sit there and do bicep isolation work. But even if you are going to do anything close to isolation work, right, if you're doing a bicep curl standing up with good posture, you're doing a whole lot more good for your body than you are if you're doing it on a machine that braces you and takes out all the other muscle groups as much as possible.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, there's some really good studies about the people who strength train with free weights end up functionally noticeably stronger than people who do the same kind of quote-unquote movements on a machine. So if I do a dumbbell press or I'm sure I think it might be a better example. Like, if I squat with
a dumbbell press, I like it. Let's take that one.
Well, I was going to use a squat one because it's an easy analogy, which is that if I do a squat with a barbell versus a squat on a Smith machine, you know, when I do it on the Smith machine, all the stabilizing muscles that are supposed to keep me upright and stop me from falling over don't have to do their job properly because the Smith machine limits my planes of movement, whereas when I squat, you know, I have to stabilize that weight. My ankles have to stabilize that weight. My knees have to stabilize that weight in a way they don't have to with the Smith machine. So the musculature surrounding, the stabilizing muscles around the joints that I use in the movement have to work harder and become stronger and have to integrate. So that's what I mean. I prefer that example just because.
Well, the one thing that I left out that I think you can also use with the Smith machine is the press, I think, illustrates it a little bit easier. If you do a press on a machine, you're sitting down, you're pressing against a bench, and the machine controls the random range of motion. If you do a press, even just with 10-pound dumbbells, and you put them up over your head and straighten your arms, well, at the very least, you have to have the balance to hold the weights over your head, right? So you're working your balance system. Like, you're doing so much more neurologically for your brain than you are when you're on a machine, that you really can't compare the two.
Right.
And so, you know, machines came about because they were supposed to be safer. But, you know, even for me, like, I studied squatting formally in school for a couple of years. The last time I used a Smith machine was in Japan, and I actually hurt myself. I was hurt for 3 months.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. I hate – I think you are far more likely to injure yourself on the static machines as a general rule than you are using free weights. I know you're running out of time. It seems like maybe a great discussion to pick up with next time. So, folks, if you have any questions or things you would like us to clarify in a future podcast, you can shoot us an email. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And if there is something completely unrelated to conditioning you'd like to hear us talk about, you can also email us about that too. We welcome pretty much the invitation to talk about just about anything related to tennis. Yeah, I don't know why that's funny. It's true.
Because it was like so obvious.
Well, I'll just say, I mean, I just wanted to limit. I didn't want people like, well, Glenn, what's your favorite recipe? Which is
right,
possible.
Yeah. What's your favorite tennis recipe? How do you make tennis cupcakes?
With lots of love, Jacob. That's how I make tennis cupcakes. Anyways, have a great day, folks, and I hope to hear from you.
See you guys.